And welcome everyone to this SEED Central event. We at HM Close, are very glad to see everyone here, and we're very excited about SEED Central. Today it's my honor to introduce our speaker tonight. Had an opportunity to meet her, I guess, a couple of months ago in Florida. I think it was in the middle of seemingly a tropical depression or something quite rainy. But Dr. Florence Negrete Sakharov received her PhD in 2005 from Purdue University in biochemistry and molecular biology. She's focused her research on a very interesting aspect of biochemistry, looking at flavor and aroma compounds applied to now into fruits and vegetables. To me, it's a very complex chemistry that she's unraveling at the molecular level and looking at all the interactions of these compounds, which is quite fascinating. I think you'll find the seminar and the presentation today to be very interesting. And I think we're very fortunate to have Florence here on campus and with us here tonight. So if you'll join me in welcoming Florence to speak, please do that now. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark, for the nice introduction, and thank you to all the organizers of SEED Central for having me tonight. It's a real honor to speak to you about my research and what's really close to my heart, what I do every day, investigating fruit volatile metabolism. And I'll try to give you some of my thoughts about how we can use this type of research to improve fruit flavor quality. Okay, so before I delve too much into a lot of details about the day-to-day research that we do, I just wanted to bring everyone up to speed about quality and flavor and what this really means, just to sort of try to make you think a little bit more about all of this. So when you ask people what quality means, you have to sort of take a step back and ask, well, where is this person in the pre-harvest or post-harvest chain, right? Because a good quality fruit is going to mean very different things to different people, right? The farmer wants a variety that is, you know, resistant to disease and high yielding, you know, so many fruits in a box, that type of thing. And then as you go along in the post-harvest chain, you find things like long shelf life. And then when you go all the way to the consumer, you find that actually, you know, consumers have grown pickier and pickier with times, and now they are demanding for higher quality flavor quality products, especially, I guess, if you live in California and you know exactly what I mean. but I guess the take home here is that ultimately, I think that consumer-driven definition of quality is really what drives marketing and drives sales, especially in terms of repeat buys. So when you ask people, well, they go to the store and they buy, you know, a bag of fruit and go home and it really doesn't taste good, it's, you know, full of internal breakdown and that sort of thing, they're not going to go back and in the store and buy that fruit. So really, there's been a lot of studies done on this, and repeat buys is very, very correlated to flavor acceptance. And this is what we're going to focus on tonight is flavor. So I just want to, again, bring everyone up to speed on what flavor is. So flavor is a very, very complicated trait, actually. When you ask sensory scientists what is flavor, they'll tell you it's really an interaction of all these things that I've listed here. So it starts with appearance, right? You actually make some decisions about what a fruit or a vegetable will taste like just by looking at it. What color is it? What shape it has? Based on your previous experiences, you're going to make a judgment already, and that can influence actually your perception of flavor when you eat it. Taste, obviously, is very important, and I'm going to focus more on these two attributes, taste and aroma, which are very, very important. And so I'll come back to those two. Irritation, pain, that's a tricky one. Not all fruits and veggies cause that irritation or pain. But, you know, a good example is when you eat chilies, you have this burning sensation or this pungent sensation in your mouth, and that comes from certain compounds that that plants produce, like capsaicin, for example, in chilies. So texture is very important, how firm it is, if there is some mealiness to it. So all of these things will have an influence on your overall perception of flavor, and temperature is also very important. So let's talk about taste briefly. There's really only five taste modalities, okay? So when people ask you what does it taste like, theoretically you only have five possible answers, right? Sweet, salty, sour, bitter, and umami, okay? So if we go a little bit deeper, and here I have some examples of classes of compounds that fruits and vegetables and plants in general make that are responsible for these taste attributes. So we would have sugars that are responsible for this sweet sensation. And so all of these, for all of these taste modalities, you have receptors on your tongue. And that's really where you perceive all of these five taste modalities. So obviously, fruits are sweet, and that comes from the sugars that are contained in those fruits, produced by these fruits. Just for a little piece of trivia, some proteins are extremely sweet as well. Monellan, tomatin are proteins that are produced by African fruits that some countries actually use as artificial sweeteners. Acids are responsible for the sour taste, and this is because of the presence of acids like citric acid, malate, tartrate in grape. That's not a good thing typically, but the bitterness of some vegetables, in cucumbers, for example, it comes from these phenolic compounds called cucurbitacins. Limonoids are responsible for that bitterness you get in citrus, right? Sometimes if an orange has been freeze damaged, it'll start producing limonoids, and that's what tastes bitter when you eat the orange. Salty, typically not a modality that we see in fruits and veggies unless you add salt, obviously. And umami, also not so present, except maybe in tomato, where you actually have a very high concentration of glutamate in the tomato. It's kind of an exception in the fruit world. But if you put salt on a tomato, you actually make monosodium glutamate naturally, so to speak. So this is why salt on a tomato is delicious, because you enhance its flavor by making MSG. It surprises a lot of people, right? okay, so let me just move on to aroma. So remember all these flavor attributes. So we had the taste, which is really important. And then remember also that really you only have five taste modalities, and these are only coming from a very small portion of the molecules that are made by the plant, the sugars, the acids, etc. Aroma, on the other hand, comes from these volatile compounds that are produced by plants that come up to your nose and that you perceive up there. In your olfactory bulb, you have receptors for these volatile compounds, and that's what induces a signal to your brain for aroma. So it also surprises people when I say it's actually, so the gene family that codes for these odor receptors is the largest family in the human genome. There's about over 300 of these genes that are active and that you constantly produce in your olfactory epithelium, and about 600 pseudogenes that sort of have decayed over time. You know, we're not really, as mammals, we're not really we're called macrosmatic because we don't have a very good sense of smell, and that's coming from the decay of these genes over time compared to dogs and mice and things like that. So so actually, your sense of smell is really, really crucial and very important for determining the quality of the food you eat. This is actually, you know, one of your first reflex when you don't know if you've put a carton of milk and you've forgotten the fridge, right? And the first thing you do before you taste it is actually smelling it to see if it's going to be good to eat. So it's actually, your sense of smell is very, very important. It also surprises most people when I say we have learned likes and dislikes. So a baby has absolutely no bias toward any particular smell and then learns to reject certain smells as they go along, whereas we have predetermined likings toward taste, for example. So babies like sweet foods and salty foods, but not bitter, because that could be toxic for them. So there are two ways that you can smell or perceive aroma. One is if you smell something, a rose or a food or anything, through your nose. And so the volatile compounds that are produced by this rose are going to go and be drawn up to your nose and are going to bind your olfactory receptors. Or you can perceive these when you eat. And in this particular case, you have a passage, an airway in the back of your mouth and in your throat that comes right back up to your nose, and that's called the retronasal perception of aroma. So this is why when you have a cold and your nose is stuck, you actually prevent this retronasal passage of aroma compounds, and that's why your people say your taste perception is altered. It's actually your aroma perception that's altered. But it has repercussions on your taste as well. Anyway, so I've been talking a lot about volatile compounds and produced by plants. So what is a volatile compound? It's an oversimplification, but in general, it's a small molecule that has a high tendency to evaporate. It's very nonpolar generally, so it's soluble in oils. So when we talk about essential oils, that's what we talk about. It's full of volatile compounds. Volatiles are produced naturally by plants, also humans. And all plant parts make volatile compounds. We can also design some chemical reactions in a lab to make them. There's actually a whole industry around the synthesis or the extraction of these compounds, right? The fragrance industry and the flavor industry. So this is what they look like. Basically, anything you can think about produces volatile compounds. So you have a few examples of structures here. So again, tiny molecules with a high tendency to evaporate, that's how they get up to your nose. And they're in wine, obviously very, very important for wine flavor as well. So each volatile compound has a particular smell, but typically we don't experience volatile compounds as a single, you don't smell beta-ionone just by itself because it's present in the mixture. And I'll talk about that in a second. So, but just to give you a few examples, if you were to come across beta-ionone by itself, it's in the aroma of a tomato, but it will be described as floral, woody, sweet, fruity, etc. So people have a very peculiar language to describe volatile smells, and it's not something that we're very used to. We're used to describing colors and shapes, but not so much describing smells. You know, when I grew up, my mom never asked me, oh, what does this smell like? You know, it's always, oh, what's this color? What's this other color? So, you know, it might kind of look surprising to you and difficult to imagine what this would smell like just by reading the description. But, you know, in the end, you get used to it. It's kind of like tasting wine, right? You pick up some different attributes of the wine. So sometimes these volatiles can have sulfur molecules in them, and that's dimethyl disulfide that's in broccoli or onion. That's probably why your kids don't like broccoli, because it's got that oniony, sulfury smell. And then the pyrazines are very important for green bell pepper aroma, actually. If you smelled this compound all by itself, you would be able to tell me right away, this is green bell pepper. Okay, so as I said, an aroma is typically a mixture of many, many different volatile compounds. So tens, if it's not very complex, but the rule is more complexity. So we typically deal with hundreds of different volatile compounds in one single fruit or one single vegetable. And the thing about them is that each and every one of them has a particular smell, but when you put them all together, they all interact to bring you a new aroma sensation. So it's a very complex thing. And for example, the aroma of a strawberry, we've counted over 200 volatile compounds, 200 different volatiles. And to make matters more complicated, our nose has different sensitivity levels to different volatiles. So I have an example up there. In the aroma of a strawberry, you find a volatile compound called furanol, to which we're very sensitive. So our nose can detect furanol at very, very low levels, 10 parts per billion concentration. Whereas strawberries also make acetic acid, okay, so it's like vinegar, but we're not so sensitive to it. It actually makes more acetic acid than furanol, but because of our difference, our different sensitivities to these two compounds, it's actually furanol that's really important for imparting the aroma of the strawberry. So there's all of these things that come into play when you're thinking about aroma as a trait. So what do we do when we say we study fruit flavors? So the kind of questions that we ask are, what kinds of flavor compounds are present in fruits? How do plants make these compounds? And what do we do to the fruit that influence these processes, that influence the production of these compounds? So answering these questions can lead to some applications. For example, define variety-specific or commodity-specific characteristics that can be related to sensory attributes. So in my work, I always try to go from the composition all the way to what compounds are really important for the particular sensation that we perceive. And then if we understand how these compounds are made in plants, you could think that theoretically we could engineer some new varieties with completely new flavors, right? And well, I've put the example of grapple here. I don't know how many of you are familiar with this. It's an example of you know, an apple that's basically dipped in a solution that smells like grape, and you know, when you taste the apple, it sort of has the flavor of grape, but it's completely artificial, right? So if you knew all the genes that were required for making grape aroma, then you could imagine that you could transform an apple and make the apple naturally, so to speak, generate these compounds by themselves. Okay. And then, of course, if we understand better how we influence the formation of aroma through pre- and post-harvest practices, then we can better control flavor quality through the production chain. So, now for a little bit of an introduction about the kind of research that I do, please don't be scared. This isn't so bad. I guess the overall topic of my talk is that things are complex. So this sort of gives you an idea of the complexity of the different biochemical pathways that are involved in making volatile compounds. The way I categorize volatile compounds, because I'm a biochemist, is by the way that they're produced in the plant. So here it's a pretty complicated slide, but it starts with sucrose that it would be imported as energy for the fruit to grow, and then the sucrose, the sugars, are just going to be broken down further and further and distributed throughout a lot of different biochemical pathways. And then along the way, you're going to be able to make these volatile compounds. Okay, so the phenylpropanoids, benzenoids come from phenylalanine, which is an amino acid. There are other amino acids, which I'll talk about in a second, that produce other volatile compounds, et cetera, et cetera. So it's, you know, there's a lot of arrows, and these things in blue here represent genes that have been identified and that are involved in producing all of these compounds. But there are thousands of volatile compounds produced by plants, and so far we know about 10% of the genes that are involved in their synthesis. So this is by no means the complete picture. There are a lot of holes still, and this is what I work on. And so on top of that, you can overlay even more complexity, and so you know you have the genetic factors that basically influence this whole pathway, and the hormones and regulatory mechanisms that tell the plant when to make a certain compound and in what quantity. Then you have climactic factors, external factors that will influence the production of these compounds, and what you do. Agricultural factors, pre-harvest, the type of soil, how much you fertilize, et cetera. So all of these factors just sort of come as an added level of complexity to the whole system. So in my lab, we study fruit flavor, and one of the systems that we work with is melon. So I argue that it's a really good system for studying fruit flavor and aroma. For one, it's a species that's highly polymorphic. So I have some examples down here of melons that are grown typically. Well, maybe not this one commercially, but most other ones are, right? And you're familiar with most of them probably. This Cantalupensis is the Charente type that we don't grow in the United States, but it's very prominent in France and Europe. They really like it over there. Reticulatus is the cantaloupe that we grow here, the Western shippers, the Eastern shippers. And this is really what I focus on because I'm in California, and so, you know, this is what we grow here. Inodorous would be your honeydews. I have piel de sapo here. This is, I have it here that there are some really good genetic and genomic tools available. So the genome of this particular melon right here has been sequenced, and the sequence is going to come out pretty soon. So that is really, really good news for the melon research community, because that is going to really help our research. So dudaim is an interesting one. It's called Queen Anne's pocket melon because it's so fragrant. People used to carry them around in the courts and as a perfume. So it's quite a neat melon. And this one is used as a cucumber. So you see there's a wide array of types and flavors and shapes. So when I first came, I started being interested in how much variability there was within the Western shipper types. And here I'm just showing you an example of the profiles that we get from the aroma of certain varieties. And, you know, maybe some of you recognize the names. This is how we collect volatile compounds. I'll maybe talk a little bit more about how we do this later, but this is a chromatographic trace or a chromatogram where each peak, each little blip here in the line represents a volatile compound. So you can see it's very complex. There's a lot of them. But overall, there's a lot of similarities between the profiles, right, between the different cultivars, and that's most likely because they're all more or less the same genetic material, so to speak. So these Western shippers definitely produce a lot of aroma. It's very diverse. But most of the compounds are common between cultivars. It's just that you have different ratios between compounds, and that's what makes each cultivar unique in the flavor pattern. But they mostly all have them, and you can see a list here. I know it probably doesn't tell you anything, but just to say that these... The most abundant class of compounds is the class of esters, and I'll talk a little bit more about those. So as you might imagine, as the melon grows in the very beginning, it doesn't produce all of these compounds. And so as it starts developing and maturing and eventually ripening, that's when the production of these esters begins. And so here on the x-axis, you have days after pollination. So in this particular case, it took 46 days to full slip, which means when the melon is fully ripe. So it starts at 35, and you see there's mostly nothing coming out of the melon. And then as you go on and go through the ripening process, then the melon starts producing these compounds. And here on the bottom right corner, I have ethylene, which maybe a lot of you know is a plant hormone that in melon signals for the fruit to go through the ripening process. So this is actually a good and bad, because you want to prolong the shelf life of melons by reducing the amount of ethylene that fruits produce typically. But at the same time, it's been shown that ethylene actually triggers the formation of aroma. So without ethylene, you have no aroma. So it's bad news, right, for the consumers because there's a little bit of conflict of interest here. But so you can see very clearly the correlation. As you start producing ethylene, you start producing volatile compounds. So in my lab, we use a variety of approaches to investigate the pathways that are involved in making these volatile compounds. We use functional genomics, where we take advantage of genomic resources that have been developed in the community. Microarray, nowadays sequencing is so, well, relatively cheap, so we've also started using next-generation sequencing to get at these issues. And but then we go even deeper, and once we have candidate genes, we try to understand what the gene does really in the plant, and that involves biochemical characterization. We put the enzyme in a tube and we see what it does. And then we want to know in the plant what the gene does, and so we do some knockout experiments to understand the function of these genes. So I won't tell you a great deal about all of this because I know it's late and people don't like seeing those pathways. But so this is the pathway I work on. You notice here at the very end of it, you have volatile esters, which are the volatiles that are mostly made in melon. And then it starts with an amino acid. I told you that there are many amino acids that give rise to these volatile esters. So part of the pathway is actually known, and there's been a lot of research on characterizing these genes. But there's somewhat of a black box over here, and this is what my lab has been interested in studying. So we, just by looking at different ways that the pathway could go, we can make hypotheses and query databases based on these hypotheses. So what we can do is, for example, look at all the genes that are expressed in a melon that does not produce many volatiles, so a mature melon, just before it goes through the ripening process, versus all the genes that are expressed in a ripe melon, which expresses all of these volatile compounds, which produces all these volatile compounds. And so by comparing the two, we can sort of derive some candidates, suspects that we could say, well, you know, they're not present here, so maybe they're involved in making volatile compounds. So we do have some candidate genes that we look at, and this one is an amine oxidase, which we found in that its expression increases during fruit development and ripening. And this branched-chain amino transferase also increases during the ripening. So, again, I was saying that we want to really understand really deeply what these genes do, so we use bacteria as mini-factories to make the enzymes that are coded by these genes, and we throw at them a bunch of substrates, and we ask, well, will they do something with them? And in this particular case, we have this amine oxidase here, and now I can draw a line there because we've basically identified a gene that we know carries out this reaction, which is what shows up here. This is the product of the reaction when we feed it this amine. So that's the kind of thing that we do. Another class of volatile compounds that is very important for aroma is the norisoprenoids. These compounds come from carotenoids, and carotenoids are pigments, right? That the orange from the carrot or the orange from the melon comes from the presence of these pigments. So all of these molecules are volatile compounds. The neat thing about those is that we have very, very high sensitivity for them. So even though they may be present at extremely low concentrations in the fruit, our nose will pick them up because we're so sensitive to them. They're very important in some fruits. They're also important in wines. And as I said, they come from the degradation of carotenoids. So here are two chromatograms showing the profile of volatiles coming from, here is Thompson seedless grapes, which I work on, and an apricot. And they all have these compounds that come from the degradation of carotenoids. So carotenoids can be degraded just chemically, naturally, or they can be degraded by enzymes that the plants produce. And these enzymes are called carotenoid cleavage dioxygenases, or CCDs. And what these enzymes do, here on the left, you have pictures of the structure of carotenoid pigments. And what these enzymes do is they come in and they break carbon-to-carbon bonds within that molecule, and you end up with the ends there of that molecule. And this is what is volatile, and this is what your nose picks up. So those carotenoid cleavage dioxygenases actually have activity toward a wide variety of carotenoid substrates. Zeaxanthin, lutein, beta-carotene is in carrots, in melons, in many orange fruits. Lutein is very present in those green fruits, so it's present in the white grapes, for example. So what we do with these genes is we can use a very neat system where we have these bacteria called E. coli that people have engineered to produce these carotenoid pigments. Okay, so here on the left here you have a strain of bacteria that has been engineered to produce beta-carotene. Okay, so you can grow it and it will produce a lot of beta-carotene for you. If you stick that carotenoid cleavage dioxygenase gene into the bacteria, it will degrade those carotenoids and the bacterium will turn white because it no longer has the carotenoids. And this is what you see here. This is a control bacterium that doesn't have the CCD. And then if you throw in the CCD, you see that beta-ionone gets produced by the breakdown of beta-carotene. So this is another thing we do. And again, we know that these enzymes have very broad substrate specificity, meaning they work on a lot of different carotenoid substrates, which then translates into a diverse volatile profile that is produced by the plant. So just to summarize this part, we can identify and isolate genes involved in aroma production, and this is going on in my lab and in other labs throughout the world. And we can start understanding the genetic mechanisms that underlie aroma formation and the diversity that we see, all these hundreds of volatile compounds that are produced that come from enzyme specificity, substrate availability, and all these kinds of things. So it's complex, but we're starting to unravel it. Thankfully, because it's no longer too expensive to sequence, a genome is still expensive to sequence and difficult, but we can use next-generation sequencing on the expression component of the expressed component of the genome, and that's fairly easy to do. So in my opinion, the next big hurdle is really the phenotyping, because we can have a lot of genetic information and genome information, but really what hinders our ability to push forward is the phenotyping. And in the complex traits such as aroma, it's really critical to be able to phenotype fast, which is not the case currently. So my lab has also been involved in another project, which Bill here has been involved with too. And that was to try to see and test for methods that would be more rapid for the analysis of volatile compounds, all the while relating that to our sensory perception, and to try to see if those methods would be good indicators for good flavor quality. And so we tested this instrument here called the Z-nose. It's an electronic nose. The advantage of the Z-nose is that it's portable, and it's a fast GC, so it's a fast gas chromatograph. That's how it looks like. So you have a small GC column in it, which means that you can actually separate compounds a little. Most electronic noses out there don't do any separation. So we think that this is a little bit more powerful. And the sensor is a surface acoustic wave sensor. So you can do an analysis in less than 2 minutes. So it's very rapid. So we're talking the actual production of the chromatogram is 15 seconds. So it's extremely fast compared to the gold standard here. All those chromatograms that I've showed you throughout my talk were produced by this machine right here, very non-portable, very expensive. But it's the gold standard. It's a GCMS, a gas chromatograph mass spectrometer. But you have runs that can go as long as 50 minutes, and the sample prep is also relatively involved. So, you know, you can very clearly see that this is faster. But you lose in resolution, right? So maybe you can think of it as QTL mapping, right? So you have a QTL, but you don't really know what gene in the genome. There's hundreds of genes under your QTL. Well, this is kind of like that. You have one peak here. There may be actually 10 volatiles hidden under that peak, but you just get one peak. Same thing with QTLs. Okay, so so the question we wanted to ask is, this electronic nose capable of discriminating between melon maturities? So we did a study where we used the electronic nose on three cultivars that are H.M. Claus cultivars. And we also coupled that with the gold standard and made some fruit quality, general fruit quality measurement and sensory analysis. And so the stages that we chose were two pre-slip stages where you don't get the abscission zone around the stem, then the green slip, a lot of force to take out that that stem. Orange slip was maybe 1 day later, and then slip plus 1 day. So an array of different maturity stages. So these are all the measurements that we did on all these melons. We looked at soluble solid content, which is a proxy for sugar content. We looked at acidity, texture, color, specific sugars and acids, ethylene, CO2, and volatiles. And then we did some sensory analysis on those melons as well. So by a trained panel. So this isn't consumer. This is really training people to describe very precisely what they taste. Okay, so they had these 15 sensory attributes, and for each of them, they scored how high the sample that they were tasting was on a scale. And so overall aroma intensity, fruit aroma. So basically what you're doing here is using people as machines to assess these particular characters of the flavor of the melon. So a really involved study, and this is the result of it. So kind of difficult to read, but the points, each point represents a variety and a maturity stage. So on the left here, all the less mature, less ripe cultivars cluster. And then as you go through the ripening process, all the ripe green slip, orange slip, slip plus one cluster on the right. And this is based on the Zeno's data. So here you have early mature and ripe. So we have a nice separation of the samples on the x-axis, and then on the y-axis we have separation according to cultivar at the ripe stage. So Navigator was up here and Mass Rico and Thunderbird were down there. Those were the three varieties we were working with. So now if you remember this map, then we can sort of virtually overlay this map with all the peaks that we found in the electronic nose, and you can see that you have the peaks out there, on the left, that represent the peaks that were higher in the less mature cultivars, and the peaks on the right would be higher in the more ripe cultivars. And then you have a separation, peak 7 and peak 12 would be higher in Navigator, and peak 8 and peak 13 would be higher in Mass Rico and Thunderbird. So we actually did find some really good candidates, at least for maturity, to separate those melons out. And so these would be good markers that we can use with the Zenos to detect maturity. And I expect that we would see, if we threw in more cultivars, we would see other peaks that would be very specific to cultivars as well. So if we add all of the measurements that we did, that was just looking at the Zenos. What we did is we took a gazillion measurements, texture, sugars, ethylene, volatiles. There were over 100 different volatiles per sample. So it was a lot of data, but if you overlay everything onto a multivariate analysis and you ask, well, can the volatile from the gold standard predict the Zenos, the physical, chemical attributes and the sensory, you find this map which essentially clusters all the cultivars that were less ripe. Now on the right, it kind of flipped, but it's okay. and then on the left, you have all the attributes that correspond to the ripe varieties. And so if you zoom in on this particular portion right here, what you find is that all the sensory attributes that represent that would be high in a ripe melon, so fruity, sweet, buttery aroma, color intensity, all of these sensory attributes cluster with volatile compounds. So we have Zeno's compounds here, Zeno's peaks, that we can use now as marker for specific sensory attributes. But really what I would like you to notice on this slide is the absence of sugar. So in this particular experiment, we did not see a very strong correlation between sugar content and these sensory attributes, especially sweet taste, which, me jumping on my soapbox and saying volatiles are really important because, what most people do is really look at the sugar content of fruits to determine their quality, and there's really a lot more to flavor than just the sugars, okay? And this is a rather complicated way of telling you all this, but hopefully that's the take-home message. So to summarize, we think we have an instrument that's a promising tool for assessing and phenotyping cultivars or, fruits based on maturity. And aroma volatiles are better descriptors and predictors for flavor attributes. And I should say, though, that the sugar differences were rather small in this particular set. So maybe that's more true when you have sugar differences that are not so big, then the volatiles are really important. But when we're thinking about breeding for higher sweetness, then maybe if you've reached the maximum potential of your variety, then maybe you can turn your attention to volatiles and by increasing or giving it a slightly different aroma profile, you may influence the perception of sweetness without actually changing the sugar content of your cultivar. So I'm almost done. I hope I've convinced you that flavor is a complicated business, but that, really it's the integration of all of these different approaches that are going to move us forward in understanding aroma better and hopefully eventually use all of these tools to breed for better flavor. Again, always with having the end consumer in mind for flavor quality. So before I close, I just want to briefly mention this electronic nose project was funded through a USDA Specialty Crops Research Initiative project. That's a multi-institution, multi-state, multi-everything project where over 30 different investigators on the project. It's led here at UC Davis by Beth Mitchum and at the University of Florida by Jeff Brecht. And so I'm part of this big team of people that are essentially trying to find ways to deliver better tasting produce to consumers. If you want to know more about it, that's the website. And I'm part of Objective 2, which is methods for measuring maturity and quality. So that electronic nose story was part of that. And I'm collaborating with Sue Ebler on this study. But part of the study was actually going out to the industry and asking people, well, do you agree with our rationale? Because we think that handling fruits better will result in higher quality product. And so we went out and we asked growers and shippers and packers and retailers if they agreed with the logic. So the logic one was better handling results in better taste. And we had overall quite a good agreement with that logic, with some people disagreeing a little bit. So, the positive reactions are here, but I just want to point out that the people who disagreed with the logic really pointed out that variety dictates taste or flavor. And that variety and harvesting time makes the big difference. So I'm throwing it out there to you because it's very, very, I think there's a realization that really the genotype and the genetic material, you can't go beyond that. If your variety is not good tasting, no matter what you do during the production and post-harvest, it's not going to get better, right? So with that, I'll thank you very much for your attention. And there's a lot of people to thank, so all the members of my lab, Min Min and Zhang Lei and Simona, are part of the Melon Project. And Yi Chia works on the keratin with cleavage dioxygenase. Sharon Coy and Scott are undergraduates in my lab that work very hard to help us with all these samples. Thank you very, very much to all the collaborators. Bill is in the audience. We work also with Jean Poulos on some other Mellon projects. And the funding comes from the USDA and the generous help of HM Claus. So with that, thank you for your attention again, and I'll be happy to answer questions.
Well, thank you very much, Florence. It's really remarkable how much is going on in fruit development, and then how much what's going on in our own biochemistry to understand the flavor and fragrances, volatiles that come off the fruit. So those of you who have written questions, if you could pass those maybe towards Francois over on that end. And in the meantime, we can open up the floor for any questions that anyone might have. So I'm going to run around with the microphone.
I have a couple of questions based on things that you mentioned along the way. Early on, you showed us some aroma compounds being produced in melons, and you were talking about days after full bloom and things like that. Do melons attract pollinators, or are they self-pollinating? I'm demonstrating my ignorance. And if they do attract them, are there aroma compounds associated with that, and are there any relationships between the aroma compounds that might be involved in attracting pollinators, and which in the end attract seed dispersal organisms?
Right. That's a good question. So they don't self. They have to be pollinated by bees or by breeders. So they do. I mean, they do attract pollinators. I'm not very familiar. It's kind of a shame because that's my background is in flower production, scent production. But I know that in the very beginning when I was here, I did a profiling of melon flowers, and the profiles are extremely different. So they don't produce esters. So there are very different compounds that are involved in attracting, but I haven't really seen any studies per se identifying which compounds are important, but that's a really good point. I mean, those volatiles produced in flowers are really important for attracting pollinators. And so that's their function. That's why we think the plants make them in the first place. And in fruits, again, there's really little to suggest that that's a mechanism for attracting seed dispersers. But I haven't talked about that, but early on in the development of the melon, actually they produce another set of volatile compounds. So no esters, but they produce compounds that have been shown to have antimicrobial or antifungal activities. And so biologists think that, you know, it's a way for the fruit to protect its seeds before it's just ready to be disseminated, right? So, and then as the seeds are ready, then they start advertising with this huge amount of volatile compounds to potential seed dispersers, which would be us in that case. But
one other question that may not be quite so so complicated, and some of the things that you were saying made me think of it. You know, initially I would have thought that enhancing the aroma of a ripe fruit would depend on causing the fruit to make more of a particular characteristic compound. But in fact, there's a lot of combination stuff going on. And is it conceivable that you could enhance the aroma by knocking something out?
It could be, yeah, it could be. So that's a really good point. I mean, and that's why it's extremely complex, because, sensory scientists just do a lot of reconstitution experiments where they look at the hundreds of compounds and then they start taking one at a time and reconstituting the aroma, and eventually they come up with a very limited number of compounds that are actually important for the particular aroma. So you can make a case that maybe by removing some compounds you take away some interactions, and it might actually result in a better flavor overall. So, I mean, there are some volatiles that produce off odors, okay, so they're not always good. And so there are a lot of volatiles that come that are produced as a result of fermentative metabolism. So that's really a problem in post-harvest, because if you put the fruits under a controlled atmosphere, low oxygen, high CO2, which prolongs the shelf life, you may induce fermentative metabolism, which in turn induces the production of compounds that really don't smell all that good. And then those compounds you will detect, or when you open a bag of lettuce and it smells funky, well, that's basically what it is. It's those volatile compounds coming from fermentation, if fermentation occurred in the bag. So that's a really good example of, if we knew exactly how they were made and we can control their production and reduce their production, then we could help out with the flavor.
So, Florence, are there volatiles that are made that aren't perceived as aromas? And if so, what would they do?
I believe that, ethylene, for example, we can't really smell it unless it's produced at extremely high concentrations. So at physiological concentrations in the fruit, our nose cannot smell. But, we have ethylene tanks in the lab just for research, and it smells. So pretty much any volatile has a smell if you have a high enough concentration. Now, okay, so there are things called pheromones, which plants are not known to produce human pheromones. But they are known to produce insect pheromones, and those typically our nose is not very sensitive to. So we have receptors for pheromones, but they don't induce, so the binding of those volatiles to those receptors don't induce an aroma sensation. They can trigger some specific behavior, but that's an example. But as far as I know, plants have not been shown to produce human pheromones. Yeah.
Questions? More questions from the audience?
Wow. Was it?
Well, let's show a few more pathways and maybe we can...
Right. A lot more questions.
Well, I think I'm going to turn it over to Francois. Thank you again, Florence.